they were coming and ducked out of his suite, leaving word that he would be back in a few minutes. An hour later, the leader of the Kansans, J.R. Burton, traced Roosevelt to Platt's room. He found the governor in the act of thumping a table and saying, "I can't do it!" Platt was lying on the sofa while his son Frank, Benjamin Odell, and Smooth Ed Lauterbach sat nearby. Nobody except Roosevelt seemed to mind Burton's intrusion. "Colonel Roosevelt, the delegation from the Imperial State of Kansas, is waiting upstairs for you to keep your promise to see them," said the delegate. His colleagues were prepared to forgive his discourtesy, having the utmost admiration for him, and were determined to place him before the convention. But if he did not meet with them at once and choose his own nominator from among them, Burton would take charge of the nomination himself. At this, reported a bystander, Platt looked friendly. Odell said, "Well, that settles it." And Roosevelt, with a melodramatic sigh, headed upstairs. Next morning, a committee of the still more important Pennsylvania delegation called and also expressed unanimous support for Roosevelt. The California delegation followed on. All day long, as the excitement of conscripting a popular candidate spread through the convention hotels, the flattering flood continued. Roosevelt greeted all comers with expressions of regret that they had ignored his wishes, but he grinned so widely that his complaints lacked somewhat in force. His resolve to stand firm began to weaken during the afternoon, and by nightfall it was all but swept away. At 10:30 p.m., a White House observer telephoned McKinley's private secretary, George B. Cortelyou. "The feeling is that the thing is going pell-mell like a tidal wave. I think up to this moment Roosevelt was against it, but they have turned his head." "If Senator Mark Hanna had not been spending the weekend out of town," wrote a Tribune reporter, "the governor might have withdrawn his statements of non-acceptance there and then." More calls flashed over the wires, to Haverford, Pennsylvania, where Hanna was dining with a shipping tycoon, and thence to the White House with a plea for McKinley to abandon his neutrality and come out in favor of some other candidate. About midnight, a cold reply came back. "The president has no choice for vice president. Any of the distinguished names suggested would be satisfactory to him. The choice of the convention will be his choice. He has no advice to give." Hanna was in a rage when he returned to the Hotel Walton on Monday, 17 June. McKinley's refusal to advise him on the choice of a running mate was a blow to his prestige and the first deliberately hostile act of their 24-year-old friendship. All things considered, this was not a good morning for Professor Nicholas Murray Butler to approach the chairman with what can only be described as an academic piece of advice. The only way to stop the nomination going to Roosevelt, Butler lectured, was to present the convention with another candidate of equally compelling personality. "You cannot beat somebody with nobody." Hanna responded to this epigram with an outburst of profanity and assured Butler that his precious governor would not be nominated. He, Hanna, simply would not permit it. When Butler asked whom the chairman might prefer, Hanna growled something about John D. Long. The chairman's mood worsened all morning. "Do whatever you damn please," he bellowed in response to a routine question. "I'm through. I won't have anything more to do with the convention. I won't take charge of the campaign." Somebody tried to soothe him by pointing out that he still controlled the party. "I am not in control. McKinley won't let me use the power of the administration to defeat Roosevelt. He is blind or afraid or something." Observers wondered again at the chairman's strange fear of Roosevelt. Hanna had never liked the man, and his dislike had deepened into something like hatred after the fist-shaking incident at the Gridiron Club in the spring of 1898. But this terror, this premonition of a national disaster should Roosevelt be allowed to stand at McKinley's side, was entirely new. At last, Hanna, losing all self-control, blurted it out. "Don't any of you realize that there's only one life between this madman and the presidency?" Mad or not, Roosevelt now posed such a serious threat to all the declared vice presidential candidates that Hanna was forced to limp into his suite shortly before lunch and ask, once and for all, if he intended to run or not. The governor would not say. He wondered how he could risk his political future by refusing a popular call. Hanna contemptuously replied that the Roosevelt boom had little to do with popularity. Senator Platt was simply using him as a tool. If Roosevelt really wished to show his so-called independence, he should withdraw promptly, publicly, and finally. That would effectively block any attempt to draft him. Roosevelt hesitated, then agreed to write a statement of withdrawal at once. An hour or so later, while Hanna was alerting the leaders of state delegations to the imminent announcement, Roosevelt sat at lunch with his wife, aides, and a few close friends. Henry Cabot Lodge was there, silent and embarrassed behind an enormous blue silk badge reading, "For Vice President John D. Long." It was his duty to wear the emblem as a member of the Massachusetts delegation, but the irony of the slogan must have grated on the sensibilities of all present. Butler's account of the luncheon implies that Roosevelt said nothing about his recent decision to issue a final statement of denial. He merely sat and listened while everybody except Lodge pressed him to do just that. Edith Roosevelt was outspoken in her insistence that the vice presidency was wrong for him. Not until after Lodge had left, with a bitter, "I must go back and be loyal to Long," did the governor allow Butler to draft a statement. The draft was appropriately terse and uncompromising. Edith approved it, and Butler handed it to Roosevelt. "If you will sign that paper and give it out this afternoon, you will not be nominated." Roosevelt stared at the document, contorting his face, as was his habit in moments of perplexity. He thought he could improve its phrasing and crossed over to the desk. Somehow the draft became a new statement entirely in his own handwriting. "Theodore, if that is all you will say, you will certainly be nominated," said Butler, aggrieved. "You have taken out of the statement all the finality and definiteness that was in mine." At 4 o'clock, Roosevelt's statement obstinately went forth. Thousands of eyes scrutinized it to the last conditional clause and found nowhere the least hint of a refusal to accept the will of the convention. As far as staving off a draft was concerned, he might as effectively have written the single word, "Yes." "In view of the revival of the talk of myself as a vice presidential candidate, I have this to say. It is impossible too deeply to express how touched I am by the attitude of those delegates who have wished me to take the nomination. I understand the high honor and dignity of the office, an office so high and so honorable that it is well worthy of the ambition of any man in the United States. But while appreciating all this to the full, I nevertheless feel most deeply that the field of my best usefulness to the public and to the party is in New York State, and that if the party should see fit to renominate me for governor, I can in that position help the national ticket as in no other way. I very earnestly hope and ask that every friend of mine in this convention respect my wish and my judgment in this matter." "It's a cinch," chuckled one delegate. "All we have to do is go ahead and nominate him." "And then 4 years from now," said another delegate. "Quite so," said a third. Chairman Hanna gaveled the convention to order in Exposition Hall shortly after noon on Tuesday, 19 June. As the thwacking echoes died away and the band prepared to strike up the Star-Spangled Banner, Theodore Roosevelt made the most famous of all his delayed entrances. Marching with military purposefulness, but not too quickly, he advanced down the aisle toward the New York delegation, his jaw clenched firm against his floating spectacle ribbons, looking neither to right nor left. 15,000 pairs of eyes admired his broad black hat, so irresistibly reminiscent of Cuba. "That's an acceptance hat," somebody quipped. And at least 10,000 pairs of hands applauded him as yells of, "We want Teddy!" swept around the auditorium. Roosevelt took fully 2 minutes to reach his seat. Only then did he stand to attention for the beginning of the anthem. From the podium, Mark Hanna, a temporarily forgotten man, gazed down with disgust. Roosevelt was holding the acceptance hat over his heart. For the rest of the day, the convention was anticlimactic and boring. A blight of listlessness, to quote Harper's Weekly, hung over the proceedings, intensified by steamy, cabbage-smelling heat wafting from the slums of West Philadelphia. Yet much aggressive activity was going on behind the scenes. Hanna, lobbying like a man possessed, bullied every delegate he could find into promises of support for John D. Long or Representative Jonathan Dolliver of Iowa, anybody but Theodore Roosevelt. White House observers, fearful that the chairman would split the party in two, telephoned Washington for advice on Tuesday night. The result was another request for decorum from McKinley. "The president's friends must not undertake to commit the administration to any candidate. It has no candidate. The administration wants the candidate of the convention, and the president's friends must not dictate the convention." But the true dictators of the convention were not McKinley's friends. Senator Platt, nursing a broken rib, was so confident about the preliminary arrangements he had made in behalf of Roosevelt's nomination that he beat a wheezy retreat on Tuesday night. He left the task of actually creating the nomination in the hands of his old friend, Matthew Quay of Pennsylvania, in Platt's judgment, the ablest politician this country ever produced. Quay was happy to undertake the work, not out of any especial love for Roosevelt, so much as a deep desire to hurt Mark Hanna. Quay was an ex-United States senator and wanted to regain office, but Hanna had blocked his efforts. To strike the chairman down in front of the National Convention would therefore be sweet revenge, and Platt, by turning Roosevelt over to him, had supplied Quay with an ideal missile. Few delegates, least of all Roosevelt, took any notice of Quay on Wednesday morning as he sat short, squat, silent, and Indian-eyed in his light suit at an inconspicuous place in the Pennsylvania delegation. He waited until Roosevelt had escorted Henry Cabot Lodge to the podium as elected chairman of the convention, a moment of great pride to both men, before rising to offer an amendment to the rules. Amid puzzled silence, Quay read a resolution to equalize and, where necessary, reduce the size of delegations at the convention, at a ratio of 1 to every 1,000 votes cast in their home states. Just what this had to do with nominating Roosevelt for vice president, none of Platt's aides could tell. But for the first time since the convention opened, there was real noise in the hall. The majority of the delegates from east and west roared approval, while those from the south howled with fear. They realized that Quay's amendment would cut their ranks in half. Republican voting was traditionally light in Dixie, and since most of Chairman Hanna's supporters hailed from the south, equalization would in effect neutralize his power over the convention. Quay's true motive dawned on the politically astute. He was not remotely interested in delegate representation. He wanted something from Hanna. Sure enough, the Pennsylvanian suggested that a vote on the amendment be postponed overnight so that the delegates would have ample time to become familiar with it. Shortly afterward, Hanna was seen crossing over and resignedly asking Quay what his price was. "If you will nominate Roosevelt," said Quay, "I will withdraw the resolution. If you won't, I shall insist upon its coming to a vote, and you know what will happen there." Hanna did. The resolution would pass on the grounds of simple fairness. He would lose his southern delegates and lose control of the convention. There would be no guarantee then even of President McKinley's renomination. That night, Hanna, grimacing at the taste of wormwood, announced that in view of strong and earnest sentiment from all parts of the country, he would support the nomination of Theodore Roosevelt for vice president. "The best we can do," he told his supporters, "is pray fervently for the continued health of the president." Roosevelt, meanwhile, sat alone in his hotel room. He had already bowed to the inevitable and would accept the nomination for what it was worth. Having finished one of the histories of Josephus over the weekend, he was now reading Thucydides. Shortly after 10 o'clock the following morning, the icy tones of Cabot Lodge announced that the business before the convention would be the nomination of candidates for President of the United States. Senator Foraker spoke for an eloquent quarter of an hour on the glories of the McKinley administration and was awarded with an ovation that reminded one observer, Murat Halstead, of the halcyon days of the plumed knight. Then 18,000 voices joined in the singing of "The Union Forever," an incomparably moving sound even to the dignified correspondent of Harper's Weekly. When one hears that sound, one must either sing or cry. Almost before the delegates resumed their seats, Governor Roosevelt had leaped up beside Lodge to second the nomination. He stared briefly into the eyes of his best friend while applause rolled around them. 16 years before, as young delegates to the convention in Chicago, they had felt the pain of defeat together and heard predictions of their political ruin. Now they were two of the most powerful men in the country, and the party was shouting homage to them. It was a sweet moment, but Lodge's face was distorted with almost agonized anxiety, and Roosevelt turned quickly to address the audience.
"Mr. Chairman and my fellow delegates, my beloved Republicans and Americans,"
an accomplished orator now, he moved confidently through his prepared text, speaking at a torrential speed unusual even for him, his body trembling with the force of his gestures. A man in the audience was reminded of a graduate in a school of acting. A woman sighed that he would make a first-class lover from the stage point of view. Here was no soft, hesitant wooer, she felt, but one who would come at once to the question and if the lady repulsed him, bear her away despite herself, as some of his ancestors must have done in the Pliocene age. While Rose Coughlin dreamed, so did Theodore Roosevelt.
We stand on the threshold of a new century, big with the fate of mighty nations. It rests with us now to decide whether in the opening years of that century we shall march forward to fresh triumphs, or whether at the outset we shall cripple ourselves for the contest. Is America a weakling, to shrink from the work of the great world powers? No. The young giant of the West stands on a continent and clasps the crest of an ocean in either hand. Our nation, glorious in youth and strength, looks into the future with eager eyes and rejoices as a strong man to run a race.
He gazed through his tossing lenses at the thousands of banners, the streamers, the bright balloons, the tricolored bunches of pampas grass, the hanging stars and stripes. The whole auditorium looked, said a nearby reporter, like a kaleidoscope. McKinley and Roosevelt were nominated by votes of 926 and 925 respectively, the governor casting the convention's only vote against himself. After that final gesture to his lost independence, he proclaimed himself a loyal member of the team and offered his services to Hanna for the duration of the campaign. The chairman told him that it would be, as far as McKinley was concerned, a repetition of the campaign of 1896. While the Democratic nominee, William Jennings Bryan, again, stumped the country on behalf of the disadvantaged classes, the president would remain at home in Canton, Ohio, and hold his customary front porch receptions to visiting deputations. Roosevelt would have to do most of the traveling and most of the speech-making. Fortunately, he was good at both. The candidate was cheerfully agreeable.
I am as strong as a bull moose, he assured Hanna, and you can use me to the limit, taking heed of but one thing, and that is my throat.
He did not wish to seem to be neglecting his duties as governor of New York, but fortunately, July, August, September, and October are months in which there is next to no work. All through that quarter of a year, accordingly, Roosevelt crossed and recrossed the country with such numbing frequency and such an incessant outpouring of his familiar political philosophy as to blur the sensibilities of all but a cataloger. Suffice to say that he traveled farther and spoke more than any candidate, presidential or vice-presidential, in 19th century history, with the exception of Bryan himself 4 years before. But Bryan in 1900 could not match Roosevelt. By 3 November, the governor had made a total of 673 speeches in 567 towns in 24 states. He had traveled 21,209 miles and spoken an average of 20,000 words a day to 3 million people. The following timetable of one undated campaign day survives from the diary of an aide. 7 a.m., breakfast. 7:30 a.m., a speech. 8 a.m., reading a historical work. 9 a.m., a speech. 10 a.m., dictating letters. 11 a.m., discussing Montana mines. 11:30 a.m., a speech. 12, reading an ornithological work. 12:30 p.m., a speech. 1 p.m., lunch. 1:30 p.m., a speech. 2:30 p.m., reading Sir Walter Scott. 3 p.m., answering telegrams. 3:45 p.m., a speech. 4 p.m., meeting the press. 4:30 p.m., reading. 5 p.m., a speech. 6 p.m., reading. 7 p.m., supper. 8 to 10 p.m., speaking. 11 p.m., reading alone in his car. 12, to bed. Inevitably, there were moments of ugliness, as when a mob of hired muckers assaulted him near Cripple Creek, Colorado, with rocks big enough to crush the iron guards on the caboose. A flying wedge of Rough Riders rescued the candidate from serious harm. William Jennings Bryan haughtily disbelieved reports of the incident, but said it was an outrage, if true. The Rough Riders, of course, were not above staging a little playful violence themselves, as when a member of the campaign special shot a populist editor for presuming to criticize my colonel. The editor survived, but stories like this revived Roosevelt's forgotten cowboy image in the East, much to the delight of cartoonists and humorists. On 13 October, Finley Peter Dunn's barroom philosopher, Mr. Dooley, summarized the campaign thus.
Well, sir, said Mr. Dooley, if there's anyone running in this campaign but me friend Teddy Rosenfelt, I'd like to know who it is. It isn't Mac, for he went away 3 weeks ago, leaving a note saying that he'd accept the nomination if 'twas offered him, and he ain't been heard from since. It ain't Brian. 'Tis Titty alone that's running, and he ain't running. He's galloping.
Mr. Dooley went on to parody a local account of one of Roosevelt's bipartisan meetings out west.
At this moment, Governor Rosenfeld bit his way through the throng, and after bringing down with a well-aimed shot the chairman of the Democratic Committee, he spoke as follows. Scoundrels, cowards, hired ruffians, I know ye all well, and if e'er a one of ye comes up to this platform, I'll show ye how I feel toward ye and fellow Republicans. This is the happiest moment of me life. A voice, kill him. Never before have I enjoyed so much living under a constitution that ensures equal rights and no more to one and all and... Excuse me, gents, while I get the red-headed man in the gallery. Got him. Thanks, and spreads over the country. Editor's note, here our reporter was struck in the back of the head with a piece of casting, but we understand that Governor Rosenfeld completed a delightful speech amid great enthusiasm and was escorted to the train by a large crowd. The list of killed and wounded will be found in another part of this paper.
Comparisons between this piece and, say, the Chicago Times-Herald account of Roosevelt's visit to Deadwood, South Dakota, on 3 October, prove that Mr. Dooley's imagination was not wholly without basis in fact. The trip also had its moments of poignancy, as when Roosevelt's train snaked down into the Badlands of North Dakota and stopped at Medora.
"The romance of my life began here," said Roosevelt, to nobody in particular.
Then, jumping down into the sagebrush, he looked around at the gray buttes, the Little Missouri, and what was left of Medora itself.
"It does not seem right," he said sadly, "that I should come here and not stay."
On 6 November 1900, the Republican Party won its greatest victory since the triumph of Grant in 1872. McKinley's popular plurality was well over 750,000, and he swamped Bryan in the Electoral College, 292-155. Much of this favorable vote could be ascribed to the nation's booming economy and satisfaction with the successful conduct of the war. But the vice president-elect was entitled to much of the credit. Party professionals agreed that by his selfless exertions, he had earned himself the presidency in 1904, if not earlier. "I feel sorry for McKinley," said one Republican campaign worker as he perused the election results. "He has a man of destiny behind him." Roosevelt divided the rest of November and December between Albany and Oyster Bay. On the last day of the year, his governorship came to an end.
"I think I have been the best governor of my time," he claimed, "better either than Cleveland or Tilden."
His record had indeed been impressive, seen in the context of history, although the Evening Post sneered at his record of partial and leisurely reform. A wide disparity of other editorial comments indicates that contemporary critics found it difficult, if not impossible, to analyze Governor Roosevelt objectively. Much of this difficulty arose out of the Roosevelt-Platt relationship, so subtle a combination of enmity and friendliness, clashes and compromise. Conservatives on the one hand and radicals on the other simply could not see how two such men could, in effect, be merged into one governor and produce legislation so puzzlingly satisfactory to both their traditional constituencies, although, of course, both regulars and reformers complained that it was neither. The evidence is that Platt himself was confused and merely trying to make the best of an awkward alliance, whereas Roosevelt, as time would show, knew very well what he was about. In brief summary, he was responding, along with such other leaders as John P. Altgeld of Chicago, Hazen Pingree of Detroit, and Samuel Jones of Toledo, to the progressive movement then developing in various parts of the country. He had been responding to it, indeed, throughout his career as a reform assemblyman in 1882, a reform civil service commissioner in 1889, and a reform police commissioner in 1895. But aristocratic paternalism had dominated his thinking until 1898. The war, which brought him confessedly closer to his men than his officers, also awakened his conscience to the needs of those less fortunate, less virile, less intelligent than himself. Having achieved his own military catharsis on San Juan Hill, he was now a politician again and found himself less interested in battles than in treaties. As such, his two gubernatorial messages could be viewed as social contracts acknowledging the continuing, though waning, power of the old guard and promising new powers to the progressives. If not the first, Theodore Roosevelt was certainly one of the first politicians to act responsibly in view of the changing economics and class structure of late 19th century America. As such, he deserves to be ranked only slightly behind Altgeld and Pengree and Jones. If his governorship, which lasted only 2 years and was subject to enormous distractions in the second, was less spectacular than some, it was spectacular enough in terms of his own membership in the social and intellectual elite. One thinks of his early contempt for unions, for Henry George, for the unwashed populists, for the rural supporters of William Jennings Bryan. Yet, as governor, Roosevelt had shown himself again and again willing to support labor against capital, and the plebeians in their struggle against his own class. After 1900, as progressivism rated a capital P and reform governors began to crowd the political landscape, Roosevelt's legislative record would look more and more modest, even cautious. But as a modern historian asks, who, in office, was more radical in 1899? With the turn of the century came private citizenship again, in preparation for the life of a dignified non-entity in his new job. Gratifying though it was to see a collected edition of The Works of Theodore Roosevelt put out by G.P. Putnam's Sons, there was also something distressingly final about the 15 volumes, as if he had already been tombstoned, a strenuous relic of the past. Apart from boning up in a few issues of the Congressional Record to see how to preside over the Senate, there was really little he could do. The frightening specter of inactivity loomed ahead. To fend it off, he left on 7 January for his first extended hunting trip in years, a chase after cougar in Colorado, and did not get back to Sagamore Hill until 23 February. A week later, the Roosevelts headed southward en masse for the inauguration on 4 March 1901. So did a party of maliciously amused organization men, headed by Senator Platt and the new governor, Benjamin B. Odell. "We're all off to Washington," said Platt, "to see Teddy take the veil." Epilogue, September 1901. A strain of music closed the tale, a low, monotonous funeral wail that, with its cadence wild and sweet, made the long saga more complete. Theodore Roosevelt's formal services to the nation as vice president lasted exactly 4 days, from 4 March to 8 March 1901. The Senate then adjourned until December, and Roosevelt was free to lay down his gavel and return to Oyster Bay. Before doing so, he asked Associate Justice Edward D. White for advice on resuming his long-abandoned legal studies in the fall, a sure sign of confusion and pessimism about the future. It was pleasant, all the same, to relax with his numerous children after so many busy years. Sagamore was at its most beautiful that spring, with spreading dogwood, blooming orchards, and the golden, leisurely chiming of the wood thrushes chanting their vespers down below. An old friend, Fanny Smith Dana, visited him that spring. As always, Theodore was vital and stimulating, but there was a difference. The spur of combat was absent. In May, he escorted Edith North to the opening of the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo, and in July and August, made 2 further restless trips west, to Colorado and Minnesota. "I always told you I was more of a Westerner than an Easterner," he explained, rather vaguely, to Lincoln Steffens. In early fall, his social schedule began to pick up, and on 4 September 1901, he arrived in Rutland, Vermont, for a short series of speaking engagements. Sometime that day, Roosevelt's eastbound train crossed the tracks of the presidential special, bearing William McKinley North to the exposition in Buffalo. 2 days later, on Friday, 6 September, the vice president attended an estate luncheon of the Vermont Fish and Game League on Isle LaMotte in Lake Champlain. With 1,000 other guests, he sat under a great marquee and ate and drank leisurely until about 4 o'clock. Then, leaving the crowd to follow him, he strolled across the lawns to the home of his host, ex-Governor Nelson W. Fisk. An impromptu reception was planned inside, at which any member of the league might come forward and shake the vice president's hand. Inside the house, a telephone shrilled. While Fisk answered it, Roosevelt stood in the sun chatting to 1 or 2 companions. Then Fisk appeared at the door and beckoned him in wordlessly. To the puzzlement of other people on the lawn, the door was locked as soon as the vice president had stepped through it. Keys were heard turning in all the other doors in the house, and volunteer guards stood at the windows. They would answer no questions as to what was being discussed on the telephone. Yet somehow, a realization swept through the crowd that the president had been shot, perhaps killed. Meanwhile, Roosevelt had put down the receiver and was addressing the house company.
"Gentlemen, I am afraid that there is little ground for hope that the report is untrue. It comes now from two sources and appears to be authentic."
He gave them the facts. A young anarchist had approached the president in Buffalo's Temple of Music with a handkerchief wrapped around his right hand. McKinley, thinking it a bandage, had reached to shake his left hand, whereupon a revolver concealed in the handkerchief blasted two bullets into the president's breast and belly. He was now undergoing exploratory surgery, and the assailant, whose name was Leon Czolgosz, had been apprehended.
"Don't let them hurt him," McKinley had murmured before lapsing into deep shock.
While Senator Redfield Proctor apprised the crowd of the details, Roosevelt and his aides left immediately for Buffalo. McKinley's condition next morning, Saturday 7 September, gave encouragement to his attending physicians. The breast wound was no more than a gash on the ribs, but the abdominal penetration was deep and serious. Both walls of the stomach had been torn open. The bullet was buried somewhere irretrievable. The most dangerous threat was of gangrene. However, there were no visible signs of sepsis. McKinley was a man of strong constitution, and he rallied amazingly over the weekend. By Tuesday, 10 September, his condition was so improved that Roosevelt, who had comported himself with extraordinary dignity and concern throughout, was told he no longer need remain at the presidential bedside. In fact, it would be best, from the point of view of publicity, if he quit Buffalo altogether. The vice president left that afternoon for a short vacation in the Adirondacks, where Edith and the children were waiting for him in a mountain cabin. He could not have chosen a destination more likely to reassure the American people that the national crisis was over and that his services would not be required in some dread emergency. The cabin stood at Camp Tahoss, the most remote human habitation in the Empire State, on the slopes of Mount Marcy, highest peak in the Adirondacks. Half a century before, Tahoss had been a little mining community. Now, thanks to the enterprise of Roosevelt's wealthy friend and fellow conservationist James McNaughton, it had been transformed into a luxury resort for hunters, fishermen, and climbers. On arrival at the camp, Roosevelt stopped at Tahoss Club, the old village lodging house, and arranged for two ranger guides to accompany him on an ascent of the mountain, beginning on 12 September. This done, he went on up the slope to his cabin in the trees. By nightfall on the 12th, Roosevelt and his climbing party, consisting of Edith, Kermit, 10-year-old Ethel, a governess, James McNaughton, three other friends, and the two rangers, were at Lake Colden, altitude 3,500 feet, where they spent the night in two cabins. The next morning, Friday the 13th, was cold and gray. An impenetrable drizzle screened off the mountain above them, and the women and children elected to return to Tahoss. But Roosevelt, who could never resist the highest peak in any neighborhood, in any weather, exhorted his elder male companions to continue climbing with him. Leaving one guide to escort the downward party, he ordered the other to lead his own up into the mists. At about 9 o'clock, they set off along the cold, slippery trail. At 11:52 a.m., Roosevelt found himself on a great flat rock, gazing out, could he but see it, across the whole of New York State. Rolling fog obscured everything but nearer grass and shrubs, yet the sense of being the highest man for hundreds of miles around, cherished by all instinctive climbers, was no doubt pleasing to him. As if in further reward, the clouds unexpectedly parted, sunshine poured down on his head, and for a few minutes a world of trees and mountains and sparkling water lay all around, stretching to infinity. Roosevelt was not a reflective man, nor was he prone now in his early middle age, he would be 43 in 6 weeks' time, to long for the past as much as he used to. But the news of President McKinley's accident, and the unavoidable horrid thrill of being, if only for a few hours, the likely next president of the United States, seems to have temporarily awakened his youthful tendency to nostalgia. Writing to Jacob Riis a few days before, he had said that a shadow had fallen across his path, separating him from those youthful days which he would never see again. Here, if ever, was an opportunity to look around him at all these lower hills and to think of the hills he had himself climbed in life. Pilatus as a boy, Katahdin as an underclassman, Chestnut Hill as a young lover, the Matterhorn in the ecstasy of honeymoon, the Bighorns in Wyoming with their bugling elks, the Capitol Hill in Albany, that freezing January night when he first entered politics, Sagamore Hill, his own fertile fortress, full of his children and crowned with triumphant antlers, the hill in Washington, where he twice laid out John Wanamaker, that lowest yet loftiest of hills in Cuba, where, like King Olaf on Smalzor Horn, he planted his shield. Now this. Would he ever rise any higher? Or was McKinley's recovery a sign that the final peak he had so long sought would after all be denied him? Mists rolled in again, and Roosevelt descended 500 feet to a little lake named Tear of the Clouds, where his party unpacked lunch. It was about 1:25 in the afternoon. As he ate his sandwiches, he saw below him in the trees a ranger approaching, running, clutching the yellow slip of a telegram. Instinctively, he knew what message the man was bringing. This is Mark Deakins. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Rise of Theodore Roosevelt by Edmund Morris. Executive producer Dan Musselman. Text copyright 1979 by Edmund Morris. Production copyright 2010 Random House Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.